Sally regards once again to the staff of Nemata and guests on the campus. This is the main professor recording on the 31st of October, 2019. Title of this unit is
Dreaming the Grand Sablon.
I just had an impulse that came up a couple of days ago due to a rare occasion. When I went into Brussels at the rotten heart of Europe, in order to meet someone at a square called La Place du Grand Sablon, the place of the big sand. In the city of Brussels, there are two gems. You might consider them to be like precious gems found in a trash heap. One is the Grand Place, or the main square of the city of Brussels, which is quite a beautiful setting with famous architecture, much of which is said to have hermetic and alchemical associations. And then up the hill a little bit from there is the Grand Sablon, or the place of the big sand. And this is another little jewel which you find resting in the trash heap of the rest of Brussels, which is an ugly mess and a mixture of various types of architecture which don't really go together. So I have spent a fair amount of my time during my life in Europe in both these places, but the Grand Sablon is particularly loaded with memories for me. It literally drips with memories. It's saturated every corner of it, every facade, every cafe, every store is saturated with strong memories of moments in my life, sometimes quite dramatic moments. And so I had the occasion actually to be there in the evening on Tuesday night, the 29th, in order to meet a gentleman.
A member, actually, of the British aristocracy.
Immediately following that meeting, the next day, I had a strong impulse to do a little talk for everyone who comes to Nemata, simply to describe something that happened that evening. Just a little anecdote, really. So I'm making this talk to share that anecdote. In a way, it's something more than an anecdote. It exemplifies a question that I live with, that everyone who comes into Planetary Tantra lives with. And it brings that question, I would say, to a point of poignant focus in a certain way. So it's in order to look again at that question, that issue, that is raised by my work, raised for myself as well as for anyone else who encounters my work, that I've decided to make this little talk. So what is the issue? It has to do with the way that you live in the lucid dream of the Aeon Sophia by comparison to the way that you live simultaneously in what is called the ordinary world. There are various ways to distinguish the ordinary world from the world you inhabit when you know that you are a living character in the dream of the Divine Mother who is embodied in the earth. There are several ways of describing the difference between these two frames of reality or frames of experience. Most simply and essentially, when you are living in her dream, knowing that it is her dream and not your dream, it's not you who's having the lucid dream, then you know that you are a character in that dream and you are playing a role in her story, in her movie. You are a character in the movie, as distinguished from others who do not know anything about the Aeon Sophia or Gnostic teaching or planetary tantra or the Shakti cluster. And those others don't know that they are living in her dream. They take the world literally, exclusively in the mundane dimension where they find themselves. You see? That's one way, and I'll confine myself to that way, to make the distinction. If you can appreciate that distinction, then you immediately know that there is always a kind of tension between the awareness of living in her dream and the awareness of living in a world that knows nothing of her dream. The master metaphor I have used to describe this situation can be found in the parable of the extras. On a movie set, there are extras. They are simply there to provide background and scenery. They don't have any significant lines. They often don't even know what the movie is about. They have no knowledge of the plot of the movie. They are not intimate with the leading actors or the writer or the director. But the team who is making the movie knows that they are making a movie, and they are simply using the extras to provide filler background for a certain scene. So, for instance, if you're sitting in a cafe, wherever it may be in the world, and you're the only person in that cafe who knows about the Aeon Sophia, sacred narrative of the fallen goddess, and everything contained in planetary tantra, well, if you're the only person in that cafe who knows that, then you are the star of the movie that is unfolding in that cafe, and everyone else in the cafe is an extra. And the cafe itself is just a setting for one scene where you appear in her dream as a self knowing participant in the dream. So I have elaborated off and on the parable of the extras, as some of you well know. The original talk on it goes back to July 2015. So in short, to once again state that distinction, and it cannot be stated enough times, but in a really cogent way, to you, the cafe is a scene in a narrative dreamed alive by the Aeonic Mother. But to everyone else in the cafe, it is a scene unto itself. It's not a setting within a setting. It's the setting. And so they take the setting literally. So the waiter in the cafe has an entire life scenario based on the act of working in the cafe. And that is his life. But to you, it is just an extra in a scene that's being filmed, that is part of a great movie, a great cinematic narrative to which you belong and for which you are responsible in some measure. That is, responsible for the way that the narrative develops, the way that the plot progresses toward its ultimate conclusion. So there's the difference in the two frames of experience. Now I'd like to take you with me to the Place du Grand Sablon and invite you to feel something of the atmosphere of the place. It's called the Grand Sablon because of sand. Sablon refers to sable, S-A-B-L-E, which is the French word for sand. So during many years when Brussels was being constructed, the streets, of course, were paved with cobblestones. And the technique of laying cobblestones is to lay down a bed of sand and then to place the stones firmly in the sand. So all the sand that came into Brussels for that purpose and other purposes as well was deposited at this place. And so it thereby gained its name. In fact, there are two parts. There is the lower part, the larger part, called the Grand Sablon. And up the road, on the other side of the big church, the Cathédrale de Notre-Dame, de Bruxelles, there is a Petit Sablon, or the Little Sablon. And I have quite an array of dense and intense memories connected with both of these locales. The shape of the Grand Sablon is roughly triangular, and the wide base of the triangle faces up against the church or the cathedral, and then the triangle slants downward to its point, and there is a street that leads from that point down to the Grand Place, or the other big square of Brussels, which is about an 8-minute walk away. So there I am, there I find myself for an 8 o'clock appointment for dinner, showing up at around 7:30. And it's dark, cold. And what happens? Well, the first thing I do is I walk into the place of the meeting, which is the NH Collection Hotel, fairly upscale hotel, maybe not 4-star, but expensive. And it is called the Netherlands Grand Sablon because it belongs to a chain of hotels run out of the Netherlands. So as I walk in there, what is my awareness as I enter the rotating door and go into the hotel? My awareness is that the hotel is a stage setting. It has been constructed for me to appear, to enact an incident in the great narrative of Sophia's dreaming. And I consider that the lobby of the hotel, the little tapas bar, and I'll get to that detail in a moment, where I wait, all of the people working in the bar, in the restaurant, at the desk, all of the help in the hotel, all of the guests in the hotel, the entire hotel itself has simply been constructed as a stage setting for me to appear. And no one in the stage setting knows who I am or if there is any such thing as the sacred narrative of the Aeon Sophia in which I am aware that I am a living character. So you get the feeling, you walk around, you might walk around with such a feeling, with a little bit of a curve of a smile on your lips, knowing this to be the case. Now, continuing with the cinematic metaphor, I want to make one thing really clear. An actor can show up on the set before the camera actually starts to run. So the question is, in this extended metaphor I'm presenting, when does the camera start to run? I can have a call to the setting. I have been called to the setting, and the camera is filming me as I appear on the setting. Her camera is always filming me wherever I am. But the scene to be enacted has not yet occurred. If I refer to myself as a star in the movie of her narrative, bear in mind that everyone who is consecrated to live their life within her life is likewise a star. So you may as well be a star. And the stars who play the leading roles in this movie, are always being filmed. But they are not always being filmed in scenes in which they interact with others who know about the movie. So there I am, all on my lonesome, walking into the lobby of the Hotel Grand Sablon, and the individual I am due to meet, who knows who I am in the context of the story, has not arrived yet. Now, that individual has read not in his image, so he knows about the narrative, and he is able to communicate and converse with me in terms of the narrative and in the terms of planetary tantra and the Gnostic message. Whether or not he will become an active player in her dream is an open question, but he is certainly on audition, you could say. He's on audition because he knows how to ask questions that are drawn from the context of the Sophianic vision of life. He's not just anyone that I might run into occasionally in a hotel or restaurant or bar or on the street. So there I am, that's the setup. And what proceeds as I'm waiting for this individual to appear? He's coming in from Poland on the high express train, I would say, probably coming through Germany to arrive at Central Station in Brussels. Okay. First thing that happens is rather amusing. It turns out that on the right, immediately as you enter the lobby of this hotel, there is a little bar, a bar restaurant. There's a big restaurant elsewhere on the first floor, on the ground floor. But there's a small bar restaurant to the right, and it's called the Hispania Bar, and it's actually a tapas bar. So I walk into the tapas bar at around 7:30, anticipating the meeting at 8 o'clock. And there's the waiter who's Spanish, and the waitress, and I talk to them a little bit in Spanish, and I ask if they have Kahlua. I ask him if he has Kahlua because I want to have a White Russian, which is made with two parts of vodka, one part Kahlua, and milk. And he says, no, but he reaches up and he pulls down a bottle of Pazo, P-A-Z-O, which is a coffee liquor from Galicia, and he's from Galicia, which is where I currently live in Spain. So the waiter is from Galicia, offering me a local liquor to make my White Russian. And I have a little laugh about that. Someone wrote that detail into the script, even involving the extras. The extras get involved without knowing what they're involved in. And so I'm laughing and chatting with him, and as well as with the attractive waitress who raises her hand and says she's from Andalusia. So there I am, immediately confronted with two extras. They're not really extras, technically speaking, because they have speaking lines. But they happen to be cast in roles that place them in an intimate relation to my life and to my personal biography. Well, that's pretty amusing. So he makes me a White Russian, and I sit there, and I proceed to wait patiently for the arrival of this individual that I'm meeting for the first time, who contacted Metahistory after having read Not in His Image. Well, I happen to have a cell phone. I hate those devices. And it so happens I was surprised that it rang, and I answered it, which is extremely rare. And it was that individual informing me that he and his wife were stuck on the train in Cologne, and that they would be late. And instead of showing up at 8 o'clock, we'd probably be around 9:30. Did I mind waiting? I said, not in the least. He said, that's fine, speaking in a warm and genial manner. We may end up burning the midnight oil. And I said, great, I'm here as long as it takes. So then I knew there would be an hour and a half, maybe longer, before he showed up. So after I finished my White Russian, I got up and I stepped outside. I thought I'd take advantage of the waiting time to walk around the place and to savor the impressions that come up for me. As I said, this is one of the locales in Brussels, perhaps more than any other, that is densely saturated with memories for me. And so indeed I did so. I stepped out into the cool winter air at 8 o'clock, and I proceeded to walk around the bounding streets that define the Grand Sablon. Now, as I explained, this place has the form of an elongated triangle, and the base of the triangle, which is higher, it's a slanting area of the city, base of the triangle stands right up against the Cathedral of Notre Dame, which is quite a large and impressive Gothic cathedral. So that's where I started to make my little circulation of the place. And I remembered, as I walked along, looking up at the cathedral, when I first came to Brussels in 1991, that it was really black. The statues, carved statues at the ground level in particular, were totally black, as if they had been covered with liquid coal, black from the emissions of automobiles and from years and years of pollution. And likewise, pretty much all the way up to the tops of the spires, I remember being, I'm repulsed by cathedrals and churches of any kind, But I remember being particularly, having a particularly unsavory impression of this cathedral because it was so filthy. Then after some years, they began to clean it. I remember that. It was being sandblasted. And I noticed on Tuesday evening that it was really spick and span. So the stone has been restored to a dark, sandy color. And the sculptures are immaculately clean. And you can examine the details. The details of the rock and stone carving that compose the decor of this cathedral are just awesome. You have to wonder how anyone could have ever carved such formations out of stone. Delicate, elaborate, flower-like shapes, in addition, of course, to the various religious personalities depicted. It's quite impressive, simply on the grounds of the handiwork and the artisanship that was involved in creating this cathedral. What I remember more than anything else about this cathedral was the many times that I looked up at the spires up into the sky, not because I found the cathedral beautiful, not because I considered the spires to represent the aspiration of the human animal to connect with its off-planet creator God. No. I looked up there because there were moments, generally I think in the spring and fall, when huge flocks of birds would gather in the center of the city and they would fly around above that cathedral and above the place, making those fabulous lyrical formations which are called the murmurations of birds, mainly the murmurations of starlings. Now, I don't know if these birds were starlings, but whatever they were, I remember seeing them and stopping, being arrested in my tracks as I stood somewhere in the place, looking up at these flowing lyrical formations hundreds and hundreds of birds flying together. And that was years before I came to use the image of murmuration to represent how we are placed in Gaia's dreaming. Murmuration is the actual tangible demonstration of a morphic field. And all of those who participate in the dream of the Aeon Sophia are in a morphic field like birds in a murmuration. So that memory came back to me and it reinforced my feeling that evening, my acute feeling, my acute self-awareness of being an actor in a huge set. That hotel, that place, that city was just a stage set for me to be that evening so that a certain episode could be filmed, a certain scene. So then I looked up the street from the corner of the church and there was, I was looking around to see if the places I knew were still there and all of them were still there. So I noticed up the street a cafe, Le Pain Quotidien, which means daily bread. And this is a real snob cafe. It's a franchise. And it was very, very big at the time that I first came to Europe in 1991. And it's grown over the years. I think it even spread to the United States. So it's a place where you can get, you know, artisanal bread of various kinds and all kinds of sweets as well as salads and those kinds of meals that are prepared for the pretentious bourgeoisie and people who regard themselves to be better than others. And I can tell you, I spent a fair amount of time in Le Pain Quotidien at the Grand Sablon, and it's still there. So then I turned and started to walk down the street, and first thing I noticed was Lola. Lola is still there. Now, Lola is another place on the Place of extreme Belgian snobbery. And I have a tendency to walk into these snob joints. I've always had that tendency. I've kind of flaunted my American cowboy character in these snob joints. I've never met anyone or even wanted to meet anyone. I've met friends there, and I've eaten there on my own. And of course, it's expensive, and the food is good and worth paying for, and the drinks are good. So I remembered lunches at Lola, and Lola is still there. So then as I walked further down the street, I sort of recited to myself the names of the places that come up, of the shops, and the names of the buildings in that old architecture typical of Brussels. Balthazar, Au Vieux Saint-Martin, Pierre Massolini. These are names of places, names of galleries. Au Vieux Saint-Martin is a restaurant in the middle of the plaza, the middle of the street, on the left as you descend. And that also is a snob joint where I used to go and eat a Belgian specialty called
des croquettes de crevettes grises, that is to say croquettes made with little gray shrimp caught on the Belgian coast.
It's a specialty of Belgium and quite delicious. And I can remember who met me for lunch at Au Vieux Saint-Martin, and what was the situation of that time. I can't remember always the conversation, but I can remember the face of the person. I remember the season, the mood. And as I stand there in front of the red awning of that restaurant, it's as if I'm saturated by vapors, which are the memories that this place holds of the moments that I lived here. And this is extremely, extremely intense. You see, what's happening is that even though all of this is merely a stage setting for me to enact a scene in the dreaming of the Aeonic Mother, I spent so much time on stage, I spent so much time filming in that setting, in that locale, that it's permeated with personal memories for me. You see, it's this a strange development of the metaphor or the parable of the extras, isn't it? So I continue strolling down the street, and at the bottom of the triangle, getting to the bottom of the triangle, there's a shop on the corner, Willy Frey, F-R-E-Y. Willy Frey is a German artisan, who makes jewelry.
Correction, Austrian artist, whose work I happen to have a certain liking for.
I bought a dolphin pin and a small ring with a Roman mosaic motif. Absolutely love the style of Willy Frey. So, standing there in front of their window display brings up a tremendous amount of emotion for me. So then I cross over at the bottom of the Place, and I start to come up the other side to walk up toward the hotel where I came from. And here again, as I do so, I am reciting the names of the places that I see. Now, the Grand Sablon is a really snobbish area, as you may already have gathered. And it's loaded with jewelry shops, pretentious decor for the house, expensive ceramic dishes, and chocolate shops. So you have Neuhaus Sablon, which is a chocolate shop, Godiva, which is famous around the world, Godiva. And then as you come around the corner and start walking up again, there is Davidoff of Geneva, which is an expensive jewelry shop, the Gallery Lorelei, which is an art gallery, Holemans and Costumans, which are furniture stores. There's a place called Macaron et Cadeaux, where you can buy macaroons and gifts. And coming up again to the entrance of the hotel, there's Wittemeyer, which is a gourmet chocolate shop. And then there's a couple of cafes, the pop-up, and another place called La Karchma. Now, La Karchma was my favorite cafe on the Grand Sablon. And actually, later in that evening, after the meeting, around 11:30, getting close to midnight, I went into the La Karchma and had a really great conversation with a man who was in there with his son, who was celebrating his 17th birthday. And we had a great conversation in French, laughing it up about many things. And he explained to me about the place. I told him of, j'ai passé tellement de bons heures ici. I spent so many good hours in this place. Des bons moments, good moments. And we hit it off beautifully. And he told me that La Karchma means little bistro in Ukrainian. So, just up from La Karchma are a couple of other pretentious shops, Messica and Christian Louboutin, Bruxelles. They all have these very Frenchy names. And then you come once again to the Grand Sablon NH Collection, the place of my rendezvous. So I made one complete tour of the square, and I was feeling, I have to say, kind of lightheaded in a way. I was feeling, what is that word? Lightheaded. Well, almost a little bit dizzy, flighty. It may have been because I was floating in the thick aroma of so many memories. You know, memories are carried in the body. Memories are like aromas. They're like scents that come to your nose or taste on your tongue. A memory to the body is like a taste on your tongue. And I was literally floating through a vapor field of memories as I walked around the setting. And it gave me a very curious impression of a kind of cognitive dissonance. After all, one part of my mind knew that this was just a stage setting, like in the sound stage at Culver City in Hollywood. It was just a place that had been constructed and populated with extras so that I could show up and film a scene in the narrative. But on the other hand, that stage setting was permeated with countless vivid personal memories for me. So you see, I was floating in both those worlds at the same time. The world of her dreaming and the world of my personal memories, living as an ordinary human being in the ordinary world, in the tonal. And I was floating and drifting between those two dimensions of experience. Well, it was still pretty early, and it was another hour before he was going to arrive, so I decided to stay outside and make another tour, make a second tour, walking around the perimeter of the place. And I bummed a cigarette, actually, from a French woman who was standing in front of the entrance to the hotel, talking to a friend. It's the only time in my life that I ever did or ever will bum a cigarette from a stranger. But she was charming and smiling. She gave me the cigarette. It was a Camel Light. And her friend lit it for me. So I leaned against the hotel and I smoked this horrible fag. And I just watched the smoke dissolve into the cool night air. And I steeped myself more and more deeply into this feeling, into this emotional mood of reminiscence. Not nostalgia, because I didn't want to go back there or relive any of that. But a deep and respectful reminiscence of what I had lived and how much I had experienced at moments in this location. And as I did so, coming up from the background of my consciousness and from the deepest part of my knowing, I could feel an awareness building. Remember at the beginning of this talk, I said that everyone who comes into PT has this awareness of living in two worlds at once. So at that moment, my knowledge of that experience started to become really acute. And I would say that it started to go to a crescendo. I felt that I was coming to some kind of crescendo in that experience, which I have had over and over again, thousands of times, and which you, all of you, each and all of you have, if you are seriously engaged in the Sophianic vision of life. I felt a kind of lifting intoxication as the crescendo came on. And so I took the occasion to roam and walk and stroll again, slowly around the plaza to savor this crescendo. And as I did so, I found myself smiling at myself as a certain part of my mind, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about here, as a certain part of my mind came in like a commentator, kind of whispering in my ear and saying things along this order. Well, you know, John, it all could be just delusions of grandeur. Look at what you've done. Look at what you've done to yourself, man. And look at what you've done to all these other people by inviting them into this immense orchestration of the dreaming of the Aeon Sophia. What have you done, actually? What kind of megalomaniac delusions of grandeur have you been entertaining all these years? And how many people have you contaminated with your megalomania? Because after all, John, it is pretty grandiose to think of yourself in this way, as a star in a cosmic narrative, walking around a stage set. And this square, this hotel, the cafes, the restaurants, you regard them simply as elaborate constructions that have been put in place for you, like a sound stage prepared for an actor. How can you be so grandiose and so arrogant? And so this little vein of thought was running in my mind. And I actually enjoyed it. It wasn't as if it was some form of self-criticism or self-doubt. It was, in fact, a kind of bemusement. I was bemused by my own grandiosity and by the scope of artistic daring of what I have done in my life work. And at that moment, I was able to view myself in bemusement and irony. And I was able to let go and surrender and say, well, you know, some people would say it's just that. The man has tremendous delusions of grandeur, and all he's ever done is create this elaborate orchestration that involves others in those same delusions. And that's really what the Sophianic vision of life is. That's really what planetary tantra is. And so what if it is just that, as long as it's true? So what, as long as it's true? But how can anyone know if it's true? I'm guessing that you can share in my reflections, some of you. I'm guessing that you can place yourself with me in the dreaming au grand sablon. I'm guessing that you can feel what I felt and share my reflections. And I'm also pretty certain that you yourself must at times have similar reflections about this experience of living simultaneously in a world that knows nothing about Sophia's dreaming, yet knowing yourself to be an active character in her dreaming. You yourself know this, as I knew it at that moment. So this is what happens next. And this is the whole point of this long and rambling anecdote. You can place yourself, as I do, in the dreaming power of the Aeon Sophia, the Aeonic Mother. You can consecrate your life to her. You can make a pact of power sharing with her. You can risk falling into delusions of grandeur and pretending, because that risk is real. But ultimately, eventually, what shows you that it is true? So I'm walking down the plus again, because it's situated on a slant. And as I get about two-thirds of the way down to the little rond-point, the little roundabout that defines the bottom point of the triangle, I see a bus. Now, I've been out there for about an hour, and there are hundreds of buses in Brussels. There are I'm certain, about 200 specific bus lines, and some of them run through the Grand Sablon. But I had not seen any bus. So as I'm walking down toward the point of the triangle, coming up a street called the Rue de Rollebec, there is a bus, a night bus. So it's about 9:30 now. And this bus, like all the other buses in Brussels, has its destination displayed in an electronic panel at the top of the bus, above the huge window where the driver sits at the wheel. It's a digital display, and it tells you where the bus is going. So when you get on it, you know exactly where you're going to end up. So I'm walking down the street as this bus comes up the street, and it pulls over at a stop in front of me. And I look at the destination panel, and what does it say? Andromeda via the Pleiades. That's actually what it says in French. Andromède via Pleiades. How do you know it's true? You know it's true in those crescendo moments when she presents you with the evidence. And at such moments, when everything you know about participation in her dreaming power and the development and enrichment of that knowledge is endless. And everything you feel that you both enjoy and suffer in that participation, and everything that you anticipate to come from that participation, builds into a certain crescendo which she can feel at the moment that you feel it, one wave meeting the other. And then she gives you the evidence. The night bus that pulls up at the stop in front of you displays on its panel Andromeda via the Pleiades.